Side 4, Old 20th, by Joe Haldeman. Continuing on page 133. She turned to Skye. No one should use the time machine until we know it's safe. Until we know that something else caused the woman's death. Proving the non-existence of a cause, I started, doesn't... She clinked her glass against mine a little forcefully. Cheers, darling. You know you retreat into formalism like an animal backing into his cave. I should have the camera on, Skye said. No, she said. Then I'd shut up, clam up, she smiled. Shut my trap, my pie hole. You have to admit the time machine does wonders for your vocabulary. It does wonders, period. A good reason to be cautious about it. Does anyone deny that it's a culture-wide addiction? With me, the main pusher. I don't know, Skye said. Something you only do a few times a year is an addiction? I don't mean an addiction in the physiological sense, but we are dependent on it. And Jacob is finding out how reluctant people have been to put off their next fix. Fix, Skye said. Exposure to a drug, I said. Only about 6% have canceled since I sent out the warning. Including me, Skye said. But I was scheduled in a few weeks, and that seemed too soon. Let other people be the guinea pigs. Like my husband? All the staff are going in as observers to map out the extent of this olfactory substrate problem, moving forward a year at a time until New York smells right again. You just have a thing for the 1940s, she said. Oh, I have a thing for almost every decade. I guess you could keep the 80s. Come on, you like being a hero, all that G.I. Joe crap. The last good war, as if there ever had been a good one. You've never tried it. No, I've never tried anything male. That would be too much weirdness at once. I just nodded. I knew she'd been male at least once, involuntarily, during Wild Year. She'd let it slip, but never elaborated on the experience. I don't switch genders myself unless it's necessary for observer mode. The novelty is interesting the first time, but after that it's just clumsy. Your brain's circuitry not matching your imaginary body. You're going back to World War II? Skye asked. Well, I'm scheduled for 1943. But I'm mainly going to New York City to sniff around. We found the olfactory baseline is normal back to 46. Other people are checking 45 and 44. If those are normal, too, I'll dive into 1943 tonight. Keep your powder dry, Kate said. Don't think I'll be wearing any, even in the Stork Club. Men didn't in the 20th. 1943. I was in a starched and pressed army uniform, razor creases, first lieutenant with a 4th Division patch and 2 overseas hash marks. The doorman nodded with a genuine smile as I entered the club. I left my coat and hat with the hat check girl. The famous solid gold chain was not in evidence this early in the evening. It was crowded enough, though, for the air to be blue with smoke. And there was muffled rumba music in a back room that was loud for an opened door second. Men with cigars talking on old-style black phones that had been brought to their tables. They looked like they expected to be recognized. I looked around for an actual famous person. Walter Winchell was ensconced at his throne, table 50, surrounded by acolytes and hangers-on. Damon Runyon sat at a corner table with Dorothy Kilgallen and 2 others. I wondered how complete their illusory characterizations were. Hemingway was nowhere to be seen. I might have been tempted to try him out. I wouldn't know a totally fake Runyon or Kilgallen from a good one, but I'd encountered Hemingway in other years, and somebody had done him in real depth. Conversation was loud and cheerful. Crystal chandeliers glittered, silk and satin everywhere. Beautiful young women in svelte and sexy outfits. Many of them no doubt jelly beans, college students whose tabs were paid in exchange for improving the scenery. The Stork Club was only one of 1,200 nightclubs in New York City, if the most sought after, and hundreds of hotels were expanding bars to provide competition. In 1943, there was plenty of mad money from military pay and defense plant salaries, and gas rationing left people pretty much stuck in the big city. The scourge of television hadn't yet opened its baleful eye, so armies of young and not young but thirsty trooped out every night to jaw with their friends and get a little tight. A pretty cigarette girl walked up and asked, "What'll it be, Loot?" "Gimme a herd, sis." She handed over a packet of Camels, good programming, and gave me a brilliant smile and little salute, but no change for my quarter. I scanned the place for Bruce and saw him sitting at the long bar. The owner, Sherman Billingsley, was a couple of seats away, staring into the 70-foot mirror, I supposed, counting the house. Bruce was in an army uniform, too, and outranked me. I came up behind him and tapped his captain's bars. "Nice railroad tracks, Bruce." "No less than I deserve." He clapped me on the shoulder, and I sat down next to him. A bartender appeared immediately, and I asked for a beef-eater Gibson. "Been outside yet?" He shook his head. "Thought I'd get a drink first, dig the joint." When we were calibrating, he mentioned he'd never done the Stork Club before. I'd been here in 49 and 52. I tipped my head toward Billingsley's reflection. "That's the big cheese, Sherman Billingsley. You catch Winchell?" "Hard to miss." He looked around appreciatively. "Good job. Solid." Rubbing the oak bar top with his thumb. My drink came. "Here's looking at you, kid." Casablanca was just opening. "Cheers." We clinked glasses and drank. The gin, onion, vinegar, and cold seemed perfectly authentic. I wondered if I'd ever again taste one in the real world. Odd for a thought like that to intrude. Bruce must have been thinking sideways, too, or maybe his virtual Manhattan was affecting him. "What if you could stay here forever?" He patted his pocket. "Never push the button." "Well, you wouldn't get bored. You'd starve to death or dehydrate first, back in the machine. Wonder what that would feel like." He dismissed that with an airy wave. "Just pretend." He selected a cigarette from a silver case and lit it with slow pleasure. "Wave a magic technical wand. Would people actually want to escape to the past and stay?" "Some would, of course. Some people will do anything. I'd rather just visit every now and then." I tore open my Camels, picked one out, and used his lighter. "Hell, if you stayed too long, you'd get addicted to smoking."
"Used to was."
"Yeah, I smoked a lot on Earth, too." The guy next to me got up slowly and took his drink away. "Perth, I mean."
"Perth,"
I said, sotto voce.
"It killed both my grandparents."
He looked at his cigarette and blew on its tip. I nodded. The Becker-Sendrick process was a boon to all sorts of unhealthy practices.
"They wouldn't outlaw it, even in my parents' time, before immortality.
Un-American to deprive addicts of freedom of choice." I saw where he was headed and lowered my voice. "There's no comparison with our situation. One death, not necessarily related."
"I know, I know."
"Smoking was bound to kill you if you didn't die of something else."
"Maybe the time machine does, too."
He stared at his reflection in the bar mirror.
"It just takes longer."
"You've been talking to Kate. What, did she promise elaborate sexual favors if you could win me over to her side?"
"No, nothing elaborate."
He put his cigarette out in the heavy glass ashtray and smiled.
"Shall we go sniff the sidewalk, while we still have a vestige of olfactory sensitivity remaining?"
He knew as well as I did that the virtual smoke wouldn't have any effect on that. "Sure." I knocked back the rest of my Gibson and kept my cigarette while I fished out a $5 bill and dropped it on the bar. We got off the stools to leave, but the bartender drifted over and pushed the $5 bill back.
"Sirs, your money isn't any good here."
That set off a little anomaly alarm, but then he said, "Good luck. Wish I could be with you. Bum back." The hat check girl gave me a broad grin when I palmed her a dollar. There was a slot in the counter for tips, but the girls never saw any of it.
loud dinner-time traffic, more cabs than cars. A bitter, cold wind cut down 3rd Avenue. I stuffed my hands in pockets and headed up 53rd. I took a deep breath of the frigid air. Smells like snow. Nothing else, though. There would be less exhaust in the air because of rationing, and you'd expect the sewage component to be small because of the cold. But he was right. The baseline just wasn't there. So where to? Someplace warm. We stopped at a kiosk, and Bruce tossed down a nickel and picked up a Times. The headline said, "Grim Tarawa Defense a Surprise. Eyewitness of Battle Reveals. Marines went in chuckling to find swift death instead of easy conquest." "Think I'll go there," I said. "God, you're a glutton for punishment." He pulled out the second section. "New Orleans for me. Nobody's shooting at you." I started to say, "Well, I researched it," but Bruce vanished before I could open my mouth. The boy behind the counter didn't seem to notice. I was suddenly warm and wet and dizzy, crowded in a small landing craft with 36 other souls. Tarawa would be the worst fight in the Marine Corps' history in terms of casualties and ferocity, and it would hold that distinction for almost 100 years until the Riyadh massacre in 2039. This was a Higgins boat, a wooden box with steel armor screwed on. Eisenhower would later say they'd saved the day in Europe, the D-Day landing, but Normandy wasn't Tarawa. The boat's 4.5-foot draft didn't quite clear the reefs at low tide. The first 3 waves of Marines had gone in with Amtraks, whose tractor wheels just ground their way up and over the coral reef. They'd had it hard enough with withering machine gun fire and pinpoint light artillery. The Marines in Higgins' boats would hang up on the reef and have to jump in and wade 800 yards through the same kind of resistance. About half would die before they got to the beach. That was what I could look forward to. But first, there was the wait. The craft had all the seaworthiness of a shoebox. It pitched and yawed with sickening randomness and had been doing it for hours. Most of the men were so seasick they would charge a point-blank machine gun nest if that's what it would take to get off the goddamned boat. Even with the strong wind that whipped over us, the smell of vomit and diarrhea was so pervasive that men would stick their heads up over the boat's protective walls into the whine and whistle of enemy fire just for a moment of fresh air. The front door was thick steel plate, which clanged periodically when random or ricochet bullets hit it. We were still in deep water, far enough from land to be out of practical range. When we moved in, that would become a danger. Several Amtraks and Higgins boats were blown apart by what passed for mortars, light artillery, and heavy grenade launchers, with all hands lost. I touched the black box in my pocket and was almost uncomfortable enough to press the button, but I did want to play this one out. "Fucking shit," a man near me said. "Another 5 minutes and I'm going to jump overboard and swim for it." "Don't forget your goddamn rifle," said the guy next to him. "I ain't going to fucking carry it in for you." The engine, which had been muttering in the background, suddenly coughed and started to roar. The coxswain peeked out from behind his steel plate shield and yelled, "Hold on to your hats! We're going in!" I took a magazine out of my utility belt, blew on it, and started to fit it into the M1's receiver. A sergeant clamped my arm. "Hold it, troop! Orders! Not until we're almost there!" Right. Forgot. He couldn't know we were about to hang up on the reef. A couple of minutes later, there was a loud crunch, and everyone lurched forward in a pile. The coxswain reversed for a second, then rammed into the reef again. A mortar round hit a few yards to our right. "Shit!" he yelled, and the front door splashed down. "Go, go, go!" The man next to me stood up and fell down, a small bullet hole between his eyes, and his brains sprayed out over 2 or 3 people behind him. A man to my left was hit and doubled over, screaming, clutching his elbow. We hustled out the half-submerged door and jumped in, holding rifles high. The water was almost up to my chin, warm as piss. Away from the boat's engine, the main sound was bullets, whishing and humming and clanging against the metal. We moved.